Welcome back. You're listening to No Dogs or Jews Allowed, the story of anti-Semitism in America. I'm Larry Josephson.
Hitler aber ist Deutschland!
Hitler came to power in 1933. Almost immediately, life became very difficult for German Jews. The 1935 Nuremberg Laws stripped them of their citizenship. Gradually, they lost all civil rights. Deborah Dash Moore says that as the noose tightened around German Jews, America could have admitted many refugees, but refused.
The sentiment in the State Department was quite anti-Semitic. Historians have often called this paper walls, the use of bureaucracy to deny immigrants a chance to enter the United States.
Richard Rothschild worked with the American Jewish Committee during the 1930s. Here's an excerpt from a 1973 oral history.
There was a wave of violent anti-Semitism sweeping the United States. It was in the papers, it was in speeches, it was on the radio, it was everywhere.
You can walk in the street in certain neighborhoods and you can hear everybody tuned into Father Coughlin.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As usual, your speaker this afternoon will be the Reverend Charles E. Coughlin of the Shrine of the Little Flower at Royal Oak, Michigan.
Father Charles Coughlin was one of the most popular radio personalities of his time. He was heard coast to coast on the CBS radio network, owned by William S. Paley, a Jew.
If we must accept Jewish leadership, that leadership will be identified with Jesus Christ, whom the Jews repudiated. Certainly, we democratic Americans and Christians have a mission of reconstruction to perform, particularly in our own nation, whose government permitted the economic system of capitalism to become enslaved by adopting the instrumentality of Jewish international banking, which is nothing more than usury.
In 1938, Father Coughlin was kicked off CBS when he made the connection between Jews and communists based on Nazi documents.
The 1917 list of those who, with Lenin, ruled many of the activities of the Soviet Republic, of the 25 quasi-cabinet members, 24 of them were atheistic Jews, whose names I have before me, published by Nazis and distributed throughout Germany.
Leonard Dinnerstein says that Coughlin's preaching intensified violence against Jews by Catholic youth gangs in big cities across the country.
Within 2 weeks of Kristallnacht, the Catholic priest gets on the air and says the Jews are communists, the Jews are terrible people, we shouldn't support the Jews.
In February 1939, 19,000 people gathered in Madison Square Garden for a rally in honor of George Washington's birthday, organized by the German-American Bund, a pro-Nazi organization.
And I venture to claim that if Washington were alive today, he would still be a staunch friend of the Germans, and as he was of Frederick the Great, now of Adolf Hitler.
Germany invaded Poland on September 1, 1939. Britain and France then declared war on Germany.
Great Britain is now at war with Germany. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced this fact in a broadcast at 6:15 Eastern Daylight Time.
Most Americans did not want to get involved in another European war. Here's A. Scott Berg.
As late as autumn of 1941, over 80% of this country believed that America should stay out of, quote, the European war. They still remembered, you know, World War I.
We cannot allow the natural passions and prejudices of other peoples to lead our country to destruction.
Charles Lindbergh became the spokesman for the isolationist America First movement. After his 1927 solo flight across the Atlantic, Lindbergh became the greatest American hero of his time. Bigger than the Beatles.
When Lindy won his fame and people cheered his name, little did he know where it would lead.
when he crossed the sea and brought fame to we. That was plucky Lindy's lucky day.
Lindbergh had lived in Germany. He had seen firsthand the rearmed German Air Force. By 1937, he felt an urgent need to warn Americans not to get involved in the coming war. He believed Nazi Germany was unbeatable.
If we enter fighting for democracy abroad, we may end by losing it at home.
A. Scott Berg won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Lindbergh.
By late 1941, Lindbergh could see a lot of the support was eroding. And so, in September of 1941, Charles Lindbergh decided to deliver a speech, and in it he was going to name what he said were the only three groups in the United States who really wanted us into the European war.
If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement.
I believe almost everybody who heard that speech agreed with Charles Lindbergh that indeed the Jews did want us in the war. I think the reason Charles Lindbergh was toppled from the pedestal as a result of that speech was not because it sounded anti-Semitic, but it sounded un-American. We are, quote, one nation under God. And basically, Lindbergh said, that ain't so. That there's an American agenda and there's a Jewish agenda.
Mr. Charlie Lindbergh, he flew to old Berlin. Got him a big iron cross and he flew right back again to Washington, Washington.
True or not, Lindbergh still looms large in the minds of American Jews as an iconic anti-Semite.
If you think an anti-Semite is somebody who hates Jews, Charles Lindbergh was not. On the other hand, if your concept of an anti-Semite is somebody who basically has this division in his mind that Jews are different from Americans, then indeed Lindbergh was anti-Semitic.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
More than 500,000 American Jews fought in World War II.
He had a bookish style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing.
Hey, there's some replacements out here assigned our squad. I brought them along with me.
Let's take a look.
This is Stein and Fowler and McHugh.
Despite wartime propaganda films showing Americans of all races and creeds fighting together in harmony, Jews experienced anti-Semitism in the military about as much as they did in civilian life. Paul Steinfeld, whose nickname was Steiny, was drafted in 1943. Deborah Dash Moore, author of G.I. Jews, tells his story.
He's sitting in a foxhole in the fortress city of Metz in Germany. He's on watch, and it's time for his partner to get his turn to go back to the foxhole. So Steinfeld runs back to the holes to wake up the guy who's the next one on watch, whose nickname was Hogtrout Charlie. And Hogtrout Charlie had clashed with Steinfeld in the past. He called him a kike, and Steinfeld was not someone to take such insults, even though such insults were dished out pretty regularly. So he wakes up Charlie, and Charlie just utters this raft of profanities, and Steinfeld loses it, and he starts slugging him, and he says, Charlie, you think that way? Why don't you go over to the other side? He said, you know, it's real close, the other side. You go over there and join Hitler's army if that's how you feel.
Most Americans were not aware of the final solution, the Nazi plan to murder every Jew they could find. By 1942, President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill had undeniable evidence of the Nazi death camps, from aerial photos, decrypted German messages, and from escaped prisoners. So the question is, why didn't the United States do more to save at least some of the 6 million Jews who perished in the Holocaust? When he was growing up in Hungary, Elie Wiesel idolized Roosevelt. He barely survived the death camps. Today, he's critical of his boyhood hero.
It began with St. Louis, the ship St. Louis.
In May of 1939, the German ship St. Louis sailed for Havana with 937 Jewish refugees who held Cuban visas. The visas were suddenly annulled by Cuban officials. They demanded $650 per passenger in bribes, almost $9 million in today's money. The refugees couldn't pay, and the United States refused to take them in. So the St. Louis returned to Europe with everyone still on board. 267 of them were accepted by England. The balance were taken by countries soon to be conquered by the Nazis. Nobody knows what happened to them.
Roosevelt knew about it because it was on the front pages of all the papers. And he wanted them back to Germany? I can't understand it. He acted against what I believe to be the most moral principle of saving lives.
Look at the politics of the situation.
Again, historian Leonard Dinnerstein.
Roosevelt becomes the first man to run for a third term in 1940. If he had used his executive emergency powers to allow the people on the St. Louis to come into the United States, it would have created a terrific uproar. His political career would be washed up.
Samuel Rosenman was one of Roosevelt's closest political advisors. He was special counsel to the White House from 1943 to 1945.
The State Department was anti-Semitic almost from the top down.
In this 1973 oral history, Rosenman explains why Roosevelt could not have done more to save European Jews.
I'm sure that if it meant bringing many hundreds of thousands of Jews here, the American people would not be sold on it. If President Roosevelt wanted to do anything, he would have to act. And acting was a very difficult thing. When you consider the opposition of the Arabs to taking them in Israel, the opposition of the Congress to bringing them here, the lack of shipping which was being sunk by the hundreds, you begin to realize some of the practical difficulties.
Roosevelt finally did something. In early 1944, he set up the War Refugee Board, whose work saved 200,000 Jews. It was too little, too late. CBS correspondent Edward R. Murrow describes what he saw at the Buchenwald concentration camp on Liberation Day, May 5th, 1945.
We proceeded to the small courtyard. It was floored with concrete. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some of the bodies were terribly bruised, though there seemed to be little flesh to bruise. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. I pray you to believe what I have said about Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I am not in the least sorry.
Then comes the fascinating period after World War II, when for several decades anti-Semitism was simply viewed as beyond the pale, certainly public expressions of it.
I think the Holocaust was a powerful influence on everything that happened in relation to Jews after World War II. The horror at what anti-Semitism could lead to.
Hollywood had avoided the subject of anti-Semitism before the war, Studio heads were warned by Joseph P. Kennedy, Roosevelt's isolationist ambassador to England, that the subject would unleash a wave of anti-Semitism against them. After the war, Daryl F. Zanuck, who was not Jewish, produced the film Gentleman's Agreement, one of the first to specifically address the subject of anti-Semitism.
I have a reservation, double room and bath, today through Thursday.
In what name, please?
Green, Philip Green.
Yes.
Gregory Peck plays a non-Jewish reporter who goes undercover as a Jew to write an exposé about anti-Semitism.
Is your hotel restricted?
May I inquire, are you? Do you follow the Hebrew religion yourself? Or is it that you just want to make sure?
I've asked a simple question. I'd like to have a simple answer.
Well, you see, we do have a very high-class clientele, and, well, naturally.
Then you do restrict your guests to Gentiles?
Well, I wouldn't say that, Mr. Green. But in any event, there seems to be some mistake, because we don't have a free room in the entire hotel.
Quotas began to fall after World War II. They did not disappear entirely until the 1960s. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg tells what happened when she graduated from Columbia Law School in 1959 at the top of her class.
When it came to hiring season, no one wants me. Many legal employers would say, please don't send us any women. And my case was particularly difficult. In the late 50s, firms were just getting over their reluctance to hire Jews. So there I was, with three strikes against me, Jewish, woman, and mother.
In 1973, Irving Shapiro became the head of DuPont. 30 years earlier, the company would not have hired Jews for any position. In 1987, Harold Shapiro was appointed president of Princeton, at the time the WASPiest in the Ivy League. Since 1992, the Anti-Defamation League has conducted four major surveys to assess American attitudes towards Jews. Abraham Foxman, national director of the ADL, describes the survey's 11 questions.
The questions are of the nature, do you believe the Jews are too powerful, too influential, unloyal Americans? And if you score 6 out of those 11 positively, you're an anti-Semite.
These surveys show that anti-Semitism has dropped significantly over the past few decades. The 2005 survey found that African Americans are more likely to have anti-Semitic beliefs than whites. This hasn't changed much since 1992, which surprises Foxman.
We would have thought that minority communities who have a history of being themselves subjects of prejudice, that they would be less intolerant, less prejudiced.
When Israel was in Egypt land, then my people let them go.
I think many blacks feel insulted when Jews will bring up this because the experiences of American blacks and American Jews are very different kinds of experiences.
Julius Lester is professor emeritus of Judaic studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's African American and an observant Jew. He converted in 1984.
Jews have white skin privilege. Being white, they could move around in society with a degree of confidence that really no black person can even now. At the same time, you have the alliance of blacks and Jews who are creating the NAACP. Later, of course, Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement.
My Jewish brothers and sisters said to me amid anti-Semitism anywhere.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
We don't need your support. We have enough Jewish power to deal with this problem ourselves. I would still take a stand against anti-Semitism because it's wrong, it's unjust, and it's evil.
Once civil rights legislation was obtained, there was a major split on an issue called affirmative action. And that was the beginning of a rift.
In 1968, civil rights leader Bayard Rustin explained that urban blacks interacted with four kinds of white people: police officers, landlords and shopkeepers, teachers, and social workers. In most cities, three of those archetypes were Jewish, all except the police officer. When many inner-city blacks saw little improvement in their lives after the civil rights movement, Jews became a target of their frustration.
You had middle-class blacks and middle-class Jews working together on civil rights, but whereas in black urban communities, you had black anti-Semitism. And so Jews sought the black anti-Semitism that came out in the 1970s and 1990s was new, but it really wasn't new. It had simply been underground.
Throughout the 1980s and 90s, some black leaders, like Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam, gave speeches laced with anti-Semitic rhetoric.
Listen, Jews, this little black boy is your last chance because the scriptures charge your people with killing the prophets of God. I am not a prophet, but I come in the footsteps of those worthies. And if you rise up to try to kill me, then Allah promises you that he will bring to bear on this generation the blood of the righteous. All of you will be killed outright.
That from a speech given at Madison Square Garden in 1985. Since the 1990s, black leaders like Reverend Jesse Jackson, who had once referred to New York City as Haimetown, have strongly condemned anti-Semitism. Outside of extremist groups, public displays of anti-Semitism have all but disappeared. Most American Jews would agree with Rabbi Ismar Shorsch, Chancellor Emeritus of the Jewish Theological Seminary.
There's no anti-Semitism left in American society.
Others disagree. They point to outrageous conspiracy theories that Jews were responsible for 9/11, or that no Jews died in the towers. Many also question whether there's any difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Jack Wertheimer.
We have to be very careful to distinguish between certain forms of anti-Israel sentiment and anti-Semitism.
This has been an argument for the last several years. Can't I criticize Israel without being called an anti-Semite? And the answer is yes. Israel is a democracy. You can criticize it.
Some of Israel's critics claim they're not anti-Semitic, but many Jews can't tell the difference. They hear echoes of old-fashioned European anti-Semitism.
There could be repercussions for Jews if there is economic collapse because of the pain and dislocation which might release more primitive impulses toward anti-Semitism or victimization. That's always a possibility.
If we look at the present-day situation, I contend that American Jews are secure. Jews are overrepresented on the Supreme Court, in the Senate, in the Congress. All of those are indications of the security that Jews have in this country today.
Perhaps the best proof that American Jews have finally overcome anti-Semitism is the 2000 presidential election.
Dear friends, 10 days ago, Al Gore asked me to be his running mate.
Al Gore felt that Joe Lieberman, an Orthodox Jew, would be an asset, not a liability, to his presidential campaign.
As I stand here before you tonight, blessed to have the opportunity I have, I know that we have become the America that so many of our parents dreamed for us. Only in America, right? Only in America.
American Jews have arrived. They occupy positions at the highest levels of American society and government. But the American Jewish experience is not unique. It's been a model for some of those who came later. Recent immigrants, Latinos, Asians, Muslims, and others, are taking a similar path and face many of the same obstacles. Today's anti-immigrant rhetoric is eerily reminiscent of the 1920s backlash against Jews, Catholics, and radicals. The new immigrants are resented or even feared by some of those who arrived earlier because they look different, don't speak English, practice a different religion, because they're willing to accept low-paying jobs, or just because they aren't Americans. In time, many of them will be. I'd like to leave you with this from John Paul Sartre. It is enough that one man hate another, for hate to gain little by little all mankind. You've been listening to No Dogs or Jews Allowed, the story of anti-Semitism in America. This program is part of the series Only in America, 350 years of the American Jewish experience. To hear this program or others in the series, and for information about podcasts, CDs, and transcripts, visit our website, onlyinamerica.info. Send your comments to only@radioart.org or call our comment line 212-595-2920. Our readers were John Lithgow and Paul Hecht. The series was developed, written, and executive produced by Larry Josephson for the Radio Foundation. This program was produced by Larry Josephson, Sarah Elzis, and Sarah Parath. It was edited by Sarah Elzis. Our script consultant is Paul Fisher. Marty Goldenson is our resident radio doctor. We had help from Sarah Kramer, Adam Goodkind, Franny Carr, Eleanor Ostrinsky, Rosa Goldenson, Maisie Tivnan, Raylan Grogan, and Diana Green. Our historical consultant is Dr. Jonathan Sarna. The interviews were recorded by Bill Sigmund, Robert Auld, Greg Smith, and Andrew Morris of Buzzy's Recording in Los Angeles. Post-production by David Rapkin and Robert Auld. A very special thanks to Nikki Newman Tanner. Thanks also to Bob Gill, who designed our logo, to my assistant, Deborah Sitopoulos, and to Andy Lancet, who runs the WNYC archives. Thanks also to John Kalish, Sarah Fishko, the DeRoe Jewish Division of the New York Public Library, for use of the American Jewish Committee Oral History Collection, the Charles A. Lindbergh Historic Site, the Anti-Defamation League, and the American Jewish Committee. This series is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation. On the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide. On the web at frostzelnick.com. And from one anonymous donor. This is Larry Josephson.
This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.